This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Jen R. You can become a Bladder Presents tipster at patreon.com/bladderpresents. And now, on with the episode.
Listen, each home run costs money. 2007, his home run total was 20, and in 2008, it was 37. That difference is a big deal when it comes to multi-million dollar contracts and free agency.
I'm back.
Tis the season, the baseball season that is, and to celebrate our national pastime, by which I actually do mean baseball, but if you thought I meant cheating at stuff, well, stay tuned. Because Billy Corbin's weird and snarky new documentary, Screwball, looks at the unholy marriage between those two concepts, and between child reenactors and centaur paintings. Long story. Mike Dunn is back to look at Screwball, plus tis also college basketball season, so we're also discussing a first season 30 by 30 by Steve James on Allen Iverson. God help the Little League squad who has to reenact this podcast. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 91. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I wrote Bill James instead of Steve James at least six times in my notes for this episode. Here to correct me every time I do so on the mic is a Mike Dunn. Welcome back.
Play ball.
Yes. Let's do that with our most wanted topic this week is the new documentary from Billy Corbin. It's called Screwball. I believe it hit theaters last Friday, March 29th, and should be on iTunes and video on demand this coming Friday, April 5th. There will be a link in the show notes. Here is the case file adapted from Wikipedia. The Biogenesis baseball scandal broke in 2013 when several Major League Baseball players were accused of obtaining performance-enhancing drugs, specifically human growth hormone, from the now-defunct rejuvenation clinic Biogenesis of America. After an ex-employee annoyed over missing back pay revealed clinic records that were, quote, clear in describing the firm's real business, selling PEDs, MLB sued six people connected to Biogenesis, accusing them of damaging the sport by providing banned substances to its players. In July of that year, 13 involved players received lengthy suspensions of 50 or more games. The future Mr. Jennifer Lopez, Alex Rodriguez, was clocked with a 162-game suspension in theory for being a cheating liar, but in practice probably at least in part for being a chronic fucking weirdo. Director Billy Corbin has brought us, actually, several 30 for 30 episodes that I quite liked, including The U Part 2, and I think it was the season 3 premiere episode, Broke, which examined why so many athletes have no money left after their playing careers end. This documentary is really bizarre. Why? What's with these kids in fake beards? Like, why is there a 10-year-old with a spray tan who's like running around in like a kimono in the parking lot of a tanning salon? The, I guess, hook of this documentary is that the reenactments are performed by children who, it turns out, are a Little League team, I guess, from Florida. I will have to look that up. They're actually hilarious. You do sort of get used to it. The kid they cast as Alex Rodriguez really looks uncannily like him. And they pasted the kid's face on a copy of the centaur painting that A-Rod apparently has had in his house for a long time. It actually didn't take that long for me to get used to those reenactments. Mike, were you weirded out by those for the whole time, or just at first you were like, what the hell?
I was initially, but then there was two points during the documentary where I said, okay, I think I'm on board now with these reenactments. Because the first thing that I thought was, so this is basically drunk history for kids. So it's PED history, kind of.
Yes.
Because, you know.
And I'm a huge drunk history fan, so that's an excellent comparison, and I think it works. Yes, continue.
Yeah. As am I, because like the first thing that I took note of was I believe the first person that spoke at all was Porter Fisher, who we will
professional we will, Tanner.
Professional Porter Tanner.
Oh,
exactly.
My God.
And the funny thing is, I have it written down in my notes as P-R-O-F dot Tanner. And I'm like, no, he was not Professor Tanner. He was Professional
Tanner. He would love
Tanner.
That, though. That yeah. Someone is calling him Professor Tan. He would love
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So I remember the first thing I saw was the show started with him speaking, and then they cut to one of the kids talking or mouthing his exact words. And I'm like, so this is PED history that Billy Corbin decided was the angle that I'm going to use to tell this story. So initially it did throw me off, but then there was two turning points for me where I said, okay, I'm on board with this now. First one was, like you said, A-Rod, the kid that plays A-Rod looks exactly like A-Rod, and he's kind of adorable.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he won me over right away. And then the second one was the scene where they're in the nightclub, which is the nightclub where supposedly they lost the vial that they were supposed to give to A-Rod. And they cut to the stage and it's Mini Pitbull.
Oh, my God. That was really good. I also enjoyed when the reporter, Tim Elfrick from, I guess, the New Times,
yes. yeah.
who broke a ton of these stories, goes to visit, was it Bosch or Fisher? I think it was Porter
I think it was,
Fisher.
No, it was Fisher. I don't think he ever really worked with Bosch,
yeah.
just with Fisher.
And he, like, the guy, he was, like, drinking Kool-Aid mixed with vodka, and he had a yes. gun on the table, and this kid has, like, fruit punch mouth. And then the Elfrick kid is this little redhead with a fake beard on who is looking extremely concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It really was good. I'm not sure the kid reenactors won me over, although the one with the terrible wig sitting next to like this giant pineapple drink
mm-hmm.
and looking at this Rolex that is like bigger than him
yeah.
did crack me up. But there were also some, like, I really liked the use of the music cues, like the one at the end especially, and the ones over Jose Canseco, which are like mm-hmm. just full of trombones, are very fun.
Right.
And I enjoyed the snarky chyrons, like that they would use stock photos of people and put an orange over their faces. And then they had one snippet.
And pineapples too, I believe.
Correct. And they have one, we don't have a clip of this, but President George W. Bush intoning during a State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm. Right.
About the, you know, the horrors of steroids, and the chyron reads, President of the United States and former President of the Texas Rangers and second worst President of the United States. And we will have that in the visual aids, which you can find on social media. That's Blutter Presents on Facebook right. and Twitter.
Yeah.
I thought they also did a pretty good job explaining how, first of all, how Bosch built his sketcho business
mm-hmm.
and how this like devolved, you know, how it connected up to MLB players, how that whole situation devolved. Like, this wasn't that long ago, but I feel like we've been through so much as a country that mm-hmm. this seems relatively minor. And I certainly didn't remember the ins and outs, or that Bosch was such a sort of not defiant but like unrepentant scumbag. And the talking head interviews they get with him, with Professor Tan, Porter Fisher, with this Jerome guy who worked for the Florida Department of Health and was like
right.
Who's the guy I'm thinking of, that the untouched, like Kevin Costner, the like federal agent, like, I'm gonna crack this case.
Oh, well, Jerome Hill was the Florida health inspector who initially I believe was a cop, right? And then he became the Florida health inspector. So he was the one that was, yes, that was gung-ho about busting these guys.
Yeah.
They
get these dudes to just like show their asses kind of during these mm-hmm. interviews in a way that's really amazing. In clip two, here is Bosch explaining why it was like kind of okay for him to basically kite his own father's legit prescription pad to run this clinic. And then here's Tim Elfrick being like, not really okay.
I didn't have prescription powers in the state of Florida, but the doctors that worked for me did.
He would find a doctor, an actual licensed doctor, to put their name on the operation. His most obvious solution was his own father, who was a licensed doctor who had a prescription pad, and it, for several of the anti-aging clinics, was listed as the medical director. Thousands of doctors retire to Florida, basically, when they're done operating a practice elsewhere in the country, and these doctors rent out their prescription pads and their DEA numbers so that people like Tony Bosch can get drugs and run anti-aging clinics, and they get a little cut of the profit. He had a prescription pad from one doctor who died while the clinic was operating and was continued to be listed as a medical director for years after his death.
Did you catch the music cue there?
Oh, the music. See, what I
do, 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 but played with a baseball organ. Oh, fucking brilliant.
It was beautiful. And actually, I remember the opening theme of the song was like this Miami Latino version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Yeah.
And that won me over right away. And I was like, oh, this is going to be completely a Miami story for the most part.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And it really gave you a good sense of place, as mm-hmm. well as a sense of sort of the timeline of what was going on and how like petty it all is. And mm-hmm. lest you get too comfortable with a sort of narrative in which Corbin is like Tony Bosch corrupted not only, you know, innocent civilians in the state of Florida who just wanted some Botox.
Mm-hmm.
He also corrupted Major League Baseball. He very quickly is like, actually, there's no one to root for here. Clip 3.
Right. Major League Baseball Productions presents Race for the Record. Never before have two men so captured the imagination of the baseball world.
I want to thank both Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa for providing us with a home run chase that has captivated sports fans around the world.
Ask any baseball scholar how important the McGwire-Sosa home run race was to bring fans back after the strike in 1994. And then ask them if that race ever would have happened without steroids. And I think that's the only answer you need about the relationship baseball has had from profiting from these drugs.
I thought this sequence was very elegantly done. That he's like, well, here's what Bosch is doing over here. And then over here, you have this already like extant situation that he almost accidentally took advantage of. Now, I, as a baseball fan, I feel like I barely remember that strike. And it really did not affect my love of the game or my enjoyment. I could have done without seeing Barry Bonds in the front seat of his gullwing Audi lecturing us on fucking pro-labor stances. But the fact is, the players should get paid. And I was fine with the strike. I went right back to enjoying the game after it. But I also really enjoyed that home run chase.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very... Well, elegant is... It is elegant, but it is also a clever way to kind of indict everyone, not just Bud Selig, who we just heard talking, and again, here for that, but that everyone is sort of complicit in this, not just MLB, but also all of us who are like, well, yeah, he looks like the Tick, but man, mm-hmm. can he mash?
And it's noteworthy that there was one thing that Corbin did not include in this segment, because this is a documentary about PEDs, because there was two things that saved baseball after the strike. It wasn't just the home run chase. And I actually remember where I was the night of that big game where McGwire and Sosa were together and they were hugging each other and they mm-hmm. stopped the game. But people maybe may not remember that Cal Ripken and his games played streak was also the other thing that basically saved baseball and brought it back from the strike. So it's, you know,
I actually did forget about that. You're correct.
Yeah. And you knew that he wasn't going to bring it up here because, you know, I don't think Cal Ripken has ever been even remotely involved in a conversation with PEDs. So
no,
there was
no
reason
for
them to bring it up here. So, and I remember actually being in a bar watching that Maguire Sosa game. So when he hit the home run, and I remember people were gathered around the TV. I mean, it really was a huge, gigantic moment, and it did really bring baseball back to where they wanted it to be.
And then,
Tony Bosch.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if it weren't Tony Bosch, it would have been someone else or something else. And exactly. You know, I remember
there was Balco in San Francisco, in California with Bonds. That was actually before.
And Balco was mentioned. Corbin made, I think, a good decision not to get too into the whole Balco Game of Shadows, like, mm-hmm. not subplot, but like parallel plot, mm-hmm. and just stick with this. And here's why Bosch was beginning to be sought after by MLB players, and people who worked for them started to reach out to Bosch, is not necessarily because the regime was so effective, but because the regime was initially undetectable. Here's clip four.
It was obvious that they were trying to get around the Mitchell report.
Now, what Tony really based his whole sales pitch on is this idea called microdosing. And if you follow my instructions to a T, you take small doses at exactly the right time, you will get the boost, you will get the energy and the strength, but it won't be enough of any of these drugs to set off the alarm bells if you get tested after a game.
So good for him. Built a better mousetrap, etc. So this is like still in the first 15 minutes of the documentary. And then A-Rod is having low T problems, a mm-hmm. fact that Corbin et al. Are more than happy to put on Front Street. Cool. And then they get into A-Rod's involvement. They get into Porter Fisher being the like groupie from hell, kind of. Who is not getting paid and decides that he's going to like sell this information to various people. And you get the absolutely fucking asinine. I had forgotten this, but he just wrote everything down in a composition book with full names and amounts.
Yes.
And then would just check them off.
Right.
So it was still legible. Like, I mean, this is absolutely this whole thing from the players to Bosch and Porter Fisher is like one for the stupid criminal is stupid catches self file.
Well, and not even just that, even just from the A-Rod angle, because A-Rod says that he was, you know, brought to this guy's attention based on the fact that it was helping, of all people, Manny Ramirez.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a reason why Manny was always referred to, or his personality was always being referred to as Manny being Manny, because he was a little bit dipsy, a little bit aloof, maybe not necessarily doing the smartest things. You know, he was the one that was like caught, you know, peeing behind the Green Monster in Fenway Park. So
the
fact that A-Rod said, oh, okay, well, yeah, whatever Manny's taken, yeah, who's the guy that's doing this for him? I want to meet him. I mean, if you didn't know at that point that Manny was going to be the one that was going to lead to your downfall, then you've got some major blind spots, and it's not quite working out. So that surprised me. I didn't realize that part of the story, that basically it was because of how much they helped Manny Ramirez that's why A-Rod decided to start using them as well.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, the noose was starting to tighten around Bosch way earlier, before any
right.
of this.
Mm-hmm.
So he lays low and doesn't seek out any new business. And then A-Rod's idiot cousin, I guess it was his cousin or whoever, A-Rod's guy is like, you're Manny's guy, right? Give us the Manny.
Right.
So he has A-Rod, and then the little details that are all around this, which are that Bosch had a big cop clientele, A-Rod is making absolutely no effort to avoid detection and is like apparently not suspicious at all that there might be like either health risks or that someone's wearing a wire or anything like that. Like, I mean, here's the thing. Like, I'm sure that this is a really smart program that could be adapted to what, you know, it's always possible to hack the test, possibly through legal means, as Ryan Braun's attorney can tell you, but that you sort of turn the drugs over and the regimen over to these players who are maybe not the best at exercising impulse control or long-term planning. And it's like, good, just do exactly what I say. Like, sure, they're going to do exactly what you say. Like, people are still getting busted.
Yeah. And I still think of where this was based. I mean, I think the reason why Corbin did the story, I felt like this was like the end of his trilogy, because not only was there the U, he also did Cocaine Cowboys, which was also set in Florida. So I felt like this was like part three of his like master trilogy about, you know, indiscretions, you know, in the Miami community for the most part. Just thinking of all these characters. I mean, that was the other thing of like my takeaways.
It is a murderer's row of Florida man archetypes, just a parade of like popper scented pieces of garbage.
Yeah. I mean, again, like, you know, I initially said up top, I was like, okay, so he's presenting this style as drunk history. But then I was like, you know what? There's also a Jersey Shore aspect to this. And this is before Boca Tanning and Mike the Situation Sorrentino is even, or whatever his last name was, is actually being used to advertise this place.
Current guest of the federal government, I believe.
Exactly. So, like, I mean, oh my God.
That's a brand, I guess.
Yeah. And by the way, I just love the names of the people in this program. I mean, you were referencing A-Rod's cousin before. His name was Yuri Sukert. Love that name.
There was Oogie.
Oogie, the black market dealer of the testosterone. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, just the baseball players. Melky Cabrera, you know, comes into this situation. The Carbone brothers.
Yes, who are introduced with a Latin-flavored mafia mandolin a la The Godfather. Like, the sound designer on this.
Oh, there were so many pop culture references in this that I saw. Like even the Bosch, you played the clip before of Bosch speaking over that music, and I was like, and he even makes reference to this when he's about to get busted. I'm like, this is Ray Liotta and Goodfellas right here.
Yeah.
That's going on.
And then there's a clip of Ray like driving around with the helicopter.
Exactly, the helicopter scaring him.
I was like, never was a documentary more designed to appeal to Sarah and Mike for real. I feel like it also did a great job being disgusted with A-Rod. And I think we have all, again, there's a lot of things that we've forgotten since a certain election year's events, because it's like, well, it's not illegal to be a jackass, and that's mostly your problem. And then he turned out to be actually pretty good at broadcasting. And B, he got together with the only other person who is as big of a self-centered, like, socially maladaptive money printer as he is, J-Lo. Like, I saw that ring. It's not fucking around. So I had forgotten what a sniveling, buck-passing child he was in response to all of this.
Right.
I mean,
as they all were at that time, they all had the exact same response. Like when they showed the clip of McGuire testifying before Congress, they all had the exact same lawyer written out message to say, I'm here to talk about the future. Let's not talk about the past anymore. And I was just like,
fucking Palmero being like, what? No, I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, I think A-Rod's statement was something like, I want you to judge me on what's going to happen going forward, And this is after he got busted the first time. Mm-hmm. So this hasn't even entered the equation yet. And that's what he's asking us to judge him on. And what happens? Well, Alex, we know what happened.
Here's clip five.
Braun is listed with other players identified as clients of Biogenesis, the shuttered Coral Gables clinic at the heart of a widening Major League Baseball doping scandal.
It later emerged that the name was leaked by Alex Rodriguez's camp. His idea was that the more people involved in the scandal, the less heat would be on him.
It wasn't only Ryan Braun on there, it was also Francisco Cervelli, a teammate of Alex. And, you know, that sucks that your own teammate throws you out there just to get the focus off of him, you know. The highest paid player in baseball history throwing this $500,000 a year ball player under the bus.
Yeah, no surprise there.
Yeah, and also, you know, I mean, it just reminds you of how, you know, this, it was kind of like the same model that, Lance Armstrong was following, too. He's like, let me get the smell of this stuff away from me and start talking about other people that are actually doing it. Mm. You know, it's just.
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to, like, in Cano's case, certainly in Cervelli's case, like, you look at a lot of these guys who got busted and it turns out that they started doing these cycles or regimens after an injury so they could come back faster.
Mm-hmm.
And someone like Cervelli, who was like the 2.5 catcher on the Yankees and like was always hoping to like get traded to some terrible team so he could play every day and make more than the minimum.
Yeah, like, I think even Bosch points out, he was like, yeah, Cervelli was only making $500,000 a year at the time versus what A-Rod's salary was.
Yeah.
You know, that's and it's how low, like, down in the pecking order he was.
Yeah, and this is what you hear over and over again in these accounts of steroids, and at least in one of Jose Canseco's books, that other people are like, look, it's an arms race. And uh-huh. Once the stars start doing it, if you even want to stay in the show, you have to start doing a cycle. And it's like, all right, I don't feel sorry for them necessarily, but I get it, especially for the journeymen who are just like, I just am trying to stay here and feed my kids. So, yeah. And then for A-Rod to turn around and be like, before I go on a date with Madonna, let me just dime some guy most people have never heard of.
Right.
To Rob Manfred, who was seriously acting like Jack Bauer.
Right.
If this documentary is to be believed. But some of our conversation on this podcast may be somewhat impenetrable if you don't care about baseball. But I don't think this documentary is. Like, I think that you will enjoy, I think that anyone can enjoy this as a just well-made, entertaining, scathing documentary about this sad chapter in sports history, even if you don't care about sports. Would you agree?
I would. I still look at the irony of, you know, Bosch being the key figure on this. And I'm looking back at all the photos of him from leading up to the day that they shot this documentary and him working at this anti-aging facility. And it worked for him. He looked worse years ago than he does now.
Yeah,
that's the thing. It's like, who came out of this the best? Okay, he doesn't have a job anymore, but he looks healthier and better than anyone else that was included in this documentary. That seems so strange, and that he came through this, I don't want to say smelling like a rose, but things are going to work out just fine for Tony Bosch, it appears.
Well, and this is not somebody who is going to get those anxiety wrinkles about being an asshole because he doesn't care. And he is still spinning clip six. And this is one of the brilliant things about this documentary, too. Like, Jerome Hill's at the end. He's the Department of Health guy.
Yes.
And the way that this is cut together and this sort of call and response between all of the among all of the figures in the documentary, I would say makes it very approachable for even for people who don't know anything about the story or baseball. Because when someone is like really obviously lying in a true crime documentary, that has broad appeal, I would say. And so does this response, clip six.
Fake and unlicensed are two different things. The way I look at a fake doctor is you wake up in the morning, you're a baker, and all of a sudden you want to be a doctor today, and you hang a fake diploma, because, you know, of course, any printer in Miami will print you a real diploma, you know? And so you put a diploma on the wall and start calling yourself a doctor. That, to me, is a fake doctor. An unlicensed physician is a physician who studied, who did their clinical clerkships, because if not, you couldn't have graduated from medical school, okay? Who might have done their resident at another in another country, but cannot acquire his license here for one reason or another.
You know what I say about that? Fuck out of here with that. You know, you can go ahead and tell Bobo the Clown about that, but you're not telling me that.
I think I might have to make that a permanent clip. Like, you know what I say to that? Fuck out of here with that. Yeah, oh, and, pretty much.
And then the happy music that immediately followed it. Da 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 da
da da da. Oh God, so good. This is about where in my notes I was like, "This is really a good time. This is a smile. This documentary, like, I am really mm-hmm. enjoying this process."
And we haven't even touched upon, because I guess we should leave something to the viewer, the comments about A-Rod's apartment and also on Manny Ramirez's sleeping habits.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
my
dream is to stay in an apartment that's just all white from top to bottom, including the floors, and having to put Manny Ramirez to sleep by reading him a story.
Oh my God. So good.
Oh my God. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, I wasn't either. And I love that he made sure to be like, in the other bed, because, you know, and I was like, I actually don't. How insecure was Manny? Does he have a blankie? Mm-hmm. I actually don't think he would care if people knew that.
And equal with A-Rod, too. I think A-Rod was always looking for a friend, you know? It didn't seem like that he didn't have many friends. And it's funny that I also yesterday watched that movie, Molly's Game, about the poker ring with Jessica Chastain.
Oh, right, right. Okay.
And after I watched it, I did a little research into it, and they actually referenced that A-Rod was part of the group that didn't play in the game, but actually just came to watch because he wanted to be around like people. People that were rich, people that had money, looking to make a couple friends. He never introduced anyone to the game. He just wanted to be included. And I just found that, you know, that on top of what we've seen in Screwball, just to be very, very revealing.
Well, you know, when he retired, I was like, I hope he gets this broadcasting job and I hope he's good at it, because I think if he can't be around this game, which is the mm-hmm. only language he really speaks, that right. he might harm himself. Like, I really thought that, because I think this guy, kid, I was gonna say, he's like 2 years younger than me. I think he just wanted to be loved and revered. Right. And when he was like a little bit too weird and too invested in that, to sort of get the sense of community and love that he apparently needed, then he's like, well, fine, I'll be the greatest of all time.
Right.
Which he probably was, but then it was like, it was just never enough and he could never yep. stop. And like, only this guy would be like, well, I guess I'll, you know, marry J-Lo. Like, well, right. that better work out, because there's no higher, like, you can't really level up from here unless mm-hmm. you're made the Pope, which I feel like is not going to happen. So,
yeah, I mean, his intent behind doing this was because I think they said he wanted to reach 800 home runs. He wanted to be the biggest home run hitter of all time. Well, didn't yeah. quite get there, but he does have J-Lo now.
Yeah.
And congratulations, kids.
Yes. Enjoy. We will await our invitations in Absolutely. What is sure to be the wedding of the millennium.
Yes, I bet this ring will be the ring that his cousin was wearing, his Yankees World Series ring. Oh,
I mean, I have one more clip before we close out this section, which is Bosch once again having like basically no instincts for self-preservation. Mm-hmm. He thinks that by giving his story to ESPN, he is going to, I don't know what his, like, he explained his rationale, but I still don't understand it. because they weren't paying him for the story and it wasn't like an arm of law enforcement. So I think what he thought was, if I just put the information out there and tell my side, that will help me. Narrator, it didn't. So he calls ESPN Deportes. They send Pedro Gomez down there. And he's been in the bar all day. I'll just let Tim Elfrick tell it. Here's clip 7.
ESPN cameras actually catch him walking from the bar, apparently after doing a solid degree of day drinking.
Who knows if he had even gone to sleep?
Well, thanks for stopping for a few questions. Some of the things they've said is that you supplied performance-enhancing drugs. What's your reaction to that?
No comment. I'm a nutritionist. I don't know anything about performance-enhancing drugs.
I had no idea what I was saying in that interview, to be quite honest with you.
Manny Ramirez was a client of yours, and in 2009, he tested positive with a prescription that was signed by your father, a doctor here in Miami.
Allegedly. That's untrue.
That your father's a doctor or that he signed?
My father is a licensed physician in the state of Florida.
Probably the sweatiest, worst interview in live television history.
I mean, like, just keep in mind when you're hearing that clip, like, it sounds like standard evasion, except A, he's like audibly drunk, and B, he called ESPN. They didn't like doorstop him outside the bar. He called them. It's just, I recommend it. Like, I understand it's video on demand and you have to pay for it and maybe you don't care about baseball. This is just fun. This is a filmmaker who enjoys the subject, really has an ear for how to put all of this together. He doesn't go to this like Michael Moore extreme of shitting on the subject. Like, occasionally there's a snarky chyron, but mostly he's just like, eh. Like, he just stands back and is like, eh? Yeah. And then at the end, it sort of, you see all the players of the, you know, acting corps on a field playing. And it's like, oh, got it. Like, but how did they find a Little League team with kids who looked exactly like all these people? I mean, It's really fun. Billy Corbin is really good at this, and I really enjoyed this, and I recommend it.
As do I, and I'll just say a couple other things. We really didn't even touch too much on the Porter Fisher character, who is very, very important to this entire story of what happened and how it's all over a $4,000 loan for the most part. Yeah. And so, you know, that's definitely worth another reason that's why this is worth watching, just to find out what his story is. And then I think that Derek Waters is probably on the phone with Billy Corbin right now saying, hey, I could use those kids. Can you give me their numbers?
They did actually do drunk and outraged very well. And like this one, the Porter Fisher kid just like is completely orange and he's in like the little paper outfit, just like running into the parking lot. And then Tim Elfrick is like, God never created a bigger natural born sucker than Porter Fisher. And then cut to actual Porter Fisher, who's like, yeah, I trust people. Like, how's that working for you?
And God bless the PED muscles that they gave some of these kids.
Oh my God. Yes. They have like sweatshirts and they're totally like stuffed at. And also honorable mention to the kid playing Pete Carbone.
Yes.
He's so good. He's really spreading a lot of mustard on the play, as they say. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I didn't know what I was going to be getting into. And I was like, is this going to be some creepy, like Todd Haynes thing, like with Barbies, except it's children, and like are they gonna cut the swears? I don't know if I like what's happening here. I did. A+, well done.
Yes. Agreed.
And I will link to Billy Corbin's 30 for 30s in the show notes. And speaking of 30 for 30s, our cold case today concerns a first season 30 for 30 that I thought was episode 8 and is sometimes listed as episode 10. The way that various platforms like list out the seasons and stuff like that is whatever. It's no crossover, The Trial of Allen Iverson. It's from April of 2010. And it is directed by Mr. Steve James of Hoop Dreams, not Mr. Bill James of Popular Crime. Although that is a crossover that I would love to see. Here is the case file, also from Wikipedia, with the note that it is Wikipedia. This entry misspelled Tom Brokaw's last name two different ways. So, grain of salt. No crossover, The Trial of Allen Iverson details a 1993 brawl involving then high school basketball player and future NBA star Allen Iverson, and how the incident and the subsequent trial and eventual conviction of Iverson divided the town of Hampton, Virginia, where Iverson attended Bethel High School. Director Steve James, a Hampton native, takes a personal look at how the Iverson incident and the ensuing aftermath, that's what an aftermath is, Wikipedia, highlighted the community's existing racial tension and put the town's problems of race relations front and center in the daily papers. The film introduces multiple Hampton natives, both black and white, as they reflect on the incident, while Allen Iverson refused to participate in the documentary. Multiple friends, neighbors, and former coaches provided insight into the life of the young Allen Iverson. I had seen this one before, but I think it had been since it first came out. Had you watched this before, Mike?
I had not seen this before. This was the first time that I saw it, and I've got to admit, I was blown away by this. I thought this was just extremely, extremely well done. The first thing that I loved about it was, even though Steve James incorporated himself into the documentary, you know, as kind of a narrator, he never put himself too far into the situation. I mean, based on the fact that when this happened back in 1993, he was in Chicago shooting Hoop Dreams.
Yeah.
He didn't have Iverson in it, and there were people that backed up, but a lot of the access to certain people that he had was fascinating. And I was fascinated by the contrast between the white participants in the documentary and the black participants in it. There was the two guys that were the sports announcers, mm-hmm. that everything that they said to me just sounded like they were walking along a slippery slope and didn't want to dabble too far into what their true feelings were. I mean, the fact that they were saying that, this guy deserved, well, if they said that he was going to get 15 years in prison, he only got 10 months. Well, that sounds like shady business to me. Not without even thinking about, but the question here and the problem is that they gave him 15 years for a bar brawl, you know, a bowling alley fight. And that's not the part that upsets you the most.
Yeah,
that they were actually going to try to put
incited,
this guy with 15 years.
Which apparently was incited by white people throwing the N-word around like they had a mm-hmm. right to do that. I mean, I had seen this before. It had been a while. I found it as affecting as I expected to. I clock Bill Simmons all the time. Mm-hmm. I regret none of that. But if 30 for 30 is in the lead of his obituary, then that's a life well lived.
That's well done.
Really smart idea. This is an outstanding series. I can think of maybe five that I was like, but this series, I think, either realized quickly or that was just the nature of the conversations that they were trying to illuminate, that mm-hmm. so much of our country's attempts to talk about race ends up getting filtered through sports.
Mm-hmm.
It's always willing to go there in the conversation. And the pinnacle of that, of course, is OJ Made in America, which is just an astounding document. I'm sure everybody's sick of my talking about it. And it's like, well, I can never watch it now because you ruined it by saying how great it is. Like, seriously, go watch it.
Yes.
If you hate it, I'll give you a dollar. How's that? Anyone within the sound of my voice, just sit there. And if you're not convinced, I will give you a dollar happily.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's great that you bring up OJ, because this case was kind of the precursor to what was eventually going to happen, because this happened only a year before the OJ trial took place.
Yeah.
So in regards to how it maps out and shows you, you know, the disparity between all the different characters in this documentary and what their feelings were and such, it kind of leads to what's going to happen a year later and with all hell breaking loose.
Yeah.
And
it's happening sort of on the opposite coast from the riots and all of those things that I think you also can't separate from OJ, mm-hmm. and which OJ Made in America does not separate from OJ.
Right.
30 for 30 is like not a perfect, it doesn't have a perfect record. It is not so good at, like, I'm still mad at that Everett Navratilova one. It was just such a little glitter puff fucking nothing. And these were like warrior queens of their sport. And it was like, let's be in a convertible. Like, it's a douche ad. Like, are you fucking seriously? They're not perfect. But what's interesting to me about that, I don't think it is like a conscious mandate, but, you know, how that's how it ends up being in a lot of 30 for 30s, and that this was made almost 10 years ago. So I think that there is some insensitivity and some dog whistling that I'm not sure would be handled the same way if James made the film today.
Right.
So even coming from James himself, in the clip that I'm about to play, this is sort of the intro where he's talking about how Iverson was always a polarizing figure, starting with this and then continuing. And the way he describes Iverson, I think, is supposed to underline the dog whistling that, you know, finger wagging white folks tend to do about African-American athletes with whose actions they don't agree. But the use of the term in the last bit is, if not advised, then it's just interesting. I'm not sure it would be written the same way today. Here's clip 8.
At barely 6 feet tall, is Allen Iverson inch for inch the most talented player ever?
I'm supposed to be a franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Or is he uncoachable?
I mean, listen, we're talking about practice. Not a game.
And as selfish a star as there ever was.
Thinking only about himself.
Is he an icon who stayed true to himself? Or a thug in basketball shorts?
I mean, when you use the word thug, you have to know how that reads to people. Mm-hmm. And I am sure that Steve James is not unaware. But this quickly goes to this quickly goes to privilege, this whole story, and the fact that none of the white people in this flap were charged with anything,
right?
That their stories were accepted, that the grainy video that someone took was kind of seen as proof, when all it really proves is that someone threw a chair. And you can't necessarily tell. And, you know, was Iverson a saint? It doesn't appear that he was. He was also 17 years old, and I would not particularly have liked to be a test case for anything at that age. And I think the film does a good job unpacking that stuff. And particularly in the talking heads from people in the community who are talking about how, like, literally how it was charged, like how he was charged was a statute that was designed to prevent lynching.
Oh yes, the maiming.
Yes, maiming by mob.
Maiming by mob. Right.
Here is a clip from a local AMC pastor explaining that, and then there's also the detective on the case who naturally is not inclined to admit any bias exists anywhere, much less in himself. Clip 9.
Maiming by mob. You know what that was about? That came into play with lynching. Trying to protect black people. So the same statute that tried to protect black people end up hanging some black folks.
In modern day, that code encompasses a lot of other crimes beyond that very serious crime. I mean, it's on the books, and it was a tool for investigators to use.
Most of the time, the system is insensitive to the feelings of the African-American community. They put us in a position where the letter of the law
exempts them from explanation.
One day, simply went to pick up my mail at the post office, and Attorney Jim Allison, he walked over and he said,
"This is a fucked up situation, and you need to get, you know, all your community activist folks, you know, Reverend Harris and just whoever else, all the rabble rousers need to come rouse some rabble about this one, because this is one that's going to be justified."
It was the worst case of racism that he had ever seen in the court system.
I just found that that way of putting it, that the letter of the law exempts the system from explanation, just devastating. Mm-hmm. I mean, so concise. And yeah, that's absolutely it.
Yeah, with no interpretation to it whatsoever. That's it. Yeah,
exactly. And then right before that, you have the white detective being like, "Well, it can mean a lot of things." And it's like, well, no. When it comes to an African-American minor who you waited to really charge until he was 18 and could get some real weight.
Right.
Like, yeah, it means whatever you say it means, white cop. How's that working? And there's some real, I do wonder what some of these, what is the term I want? Performatively colorblind commentators might have said differently here in 2019. Because there are a couple that you're like, okay, you're being a little like, I have black friends about this, but it's basically harmless. But you also have a couple of guys, one of whom, not for nothing, really looked a lot like Don Imus, who are like,
oh my goodness,
basically accused the African-American community of engaging in self-pity and like victim and being victims.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but they are victims, yeah. Dude.
And it's crazy because it was what, just this last Friday night that I think it was Pat Buchanan made the comment about how black people still have not assimilated themselves into this country. And it's kind of like the same lines of comments that are being made by a lot of the white characters. The white people in this documentary, those two, like I said, those two high school sports announcers, even the writer from the sports writer who I'll give him points for attending that one rally where they were basically yelling at for trying to equate, you know, white racist terms versus the N-word.
Yeah.
That he actually was
and
able
he
to
just
stand
had
there
to stand
and
there and take it
yeah.
at this church service, and he did not, to his credit, in a like present day talking head, was not like, he was like, yeah, that hurt my feelings. So I was like, okay, yeah. Like thank you for just leaving it there, because yeah, to be like, well, how would you like it if, like, I don't like it if I'm called honky, but I'm not going to throw a chair about it. Like, yes, that's absolutely equivalent.
Yeah, the
dumbass.
False equivalency is just so, oh my goodness,
but
don't get me started.
He's not the worst one.
No, he's not. Not far
Lester
from it.
Lester Munson of Sports Illustrated, among others. He's the guy that I just wanted to kind of punch in the dick. For being like, well, you know, don't go about in pity for yourself. Like, really, dude? Here's clip 10, and then we can talk about it more.
When there's particularly a black male athlete in trouble, there is an automatic support factor that kicks in that no matter what the charges,
get rid of racism,
there will be a large number of people who will say the white establishment is, quote unquote, trying to bring a black man down. The court system in Virginia, do I think there are problems involving race? Yes, there are to this day. But they could have had a better case than Allen Iverson.
If the passions about this incident haven't diminished much over the years, the willingness to speak out has. I'm encountering strong suspicion and reluctance.
I mean, really? I mean, I'll get into that last bit later, but there's just something about the, like, you know, if you wanted to point out the ways that the white establishment is completely stacked against particularly young African-American males, then you needed a perfect, blameless example. Like, that's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it works.
And I wish, I mean, I want to know, why was Lester Munson chosen to be in this? He wasn't the one that wrote the Sports Illustrated article. So I was wondering if he was just the editor at the time. Like, when he was making his comments, I was like,
yeah, who did write the article?
It was someone named Ned Zeman or Zeman.
Oh, yeah, Zeman. That's right.
Yeah. And I kept thinking about the article that was written that supposedly pissed off white America, that it basically was the first story or article to look at it from Iverson's side of the story. So the fact that they then brought in Lester Munson to what I thought was contradict his own writer's story, I found to be just an odd placement in this documentary. It was like the one thing that I didn't understand being used in this tale at all. So that's like the only thing, that was the only knock that I had, you know, against Steve James on this. I'm like, I don't understand the placement of this here, Steve.
Well, I understood it because I think he was trying to use any number of, like, this guy is the white establishment also, because this case was tried in the court of public opinion as much as in actual court. And I think that that's something that kids who are sort of on the verge of big, like, public sports careers have to contend with. Much more so today, probably, than even 25 years ago. But I think he definitely wanted to get as many of these dudes on the record being kind of obliviously privileged and biased as he could, and just be like, well, even these, like, well-meaning guys, or they think they're well-meaning.
Right.
But they're like, well, it's not really fair that the black community will stick up for black athletes no matter what they are accused of doing. And it's like, well, what? Like, I would argue with that, but it doesn't exactly make any sense. And once again, it's a false equivalency. It's a straw man.
Right.
And, like, shut up, guy. Anyway, then tied into that, you have, I think, Steve James's position here, which is, like, he is encountering suspicion and reluctance. And then you have an activist and teacher, Joyce Hobson, who waited a really long time to say yes, and then explains to him exactly why she did so. And that's clip 11.
Really, I'm reluctant to do this interview because, I think, again, it's critical that African Americans tell their stories. You couldn't paint it because I lived it. I experienced it. When you look up and a story is being told and commented on and analyzed by only white journalists, then that in and of itself is very callous.
I think it's one of the reasons why I decided to tell this story from the point of view of who I am. I'm trying to understand as a white guy who grew up here.
Right.
And I'm trying to understand what it was like for you, which I do think one can do, because if we can't, there's no hope, you know?
Okay, all right.
I mean, I respect that Hobson is not having it, but I don't know. I just think it raises a lot of really interesting questions about who this story belongs to.
Right.
And does Steve James have some, I don't know how to put this, cultural credit, let's say, for Hoop Dreams and for The Interrupters and for doing a lot of, actually, I'm not sure The Interrupters was him. I know it was Kurt Temkin. Anyway.
There was also Stevie that he did.
Yeah. And does he have that cultural credit from embedding in the lives of those people and trying to tell it from the inside, even though there's a, you know, there's a place past which he can't go in terms of the lived experience? Like, I think her point is, like, I agree with her that I would be very interested to see And actually, there is a documentary called Iverson that I think was on Showtime last year, the year before, and it's on Netflix, and I haven't seen it, and I don't know who directed it, but I would be interested to see this project from a person of color, because I think the questions that you ask are different, and I think the people that participate are different. But I'm wondering what you thought about, first of all, James's like position here, and second of all, was that, even though it didn't sort of address or answer the questions, was it was the raising worthwhile, I would say?
Well, those 45 seconds that you just played was actually my favorite part of this documentary, was that question and answer that he had with Joyce Hobson. And the reason why I liked it so much was because you still didn't get the feeling from Joyce Hobson that she still felt like it was right for her to participate in this, and that she still wasn't trustworthy of Steve James with this story. There's even that point at the end of it where he laughs a little bit in regards to why he wanted to do this. And when he did that, I looked at Troy, and I don't think he did it, you know, to think that there was something actually really funny. I think it may have just been like a little nervous laugh at the end.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it was totally awk. He was right?
Yeah. And she was like, not really, but whatever. You know, that was like the look and the impression that she was giving when he made that comment. So,
yeah, I think that he's even, like, that she's in this position, I think, that many activists, of color and otherwise, find themselves in, of just being like, I am tired of giving you a sticker.
Right.
For caring.
Yes.
And like, I think that like Steve James doesn't need a sticker from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But he, I think he is trying, but I also think that it's great that she reacted the way she did and that he left it in, because he's like, well, I'm just trying to understand. And she's like, well, you can't. And I'm tired of helping people try, and I'm not going to help you in this situation. Be uncomfortable. Welcome to my life.
Right.
And he took it. And he like, he clearly, I mean, she is formidable, and he was just like, well, here's, you know, here's this thing that made us all question a lot of other things. And that's art, is what that is. So,
yes, when he asked her that question, he was like, or when he makes the comment, he's like, well, you know, when she asks, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to talk to all of us? Why do you want to bring this back up again? And I think it was the point of his movie. He wasn't going to try to prove that, you know, everything is hunky dory in this country between black and whites, or that that we're all at each other's throats. It's where everyone says we need to have the conversation, right, about race in this country. And that's what he's trying to do. And he's not coming from a position of ill will, or trying to prove that racism does or doesn't exist. He is just trying to, I think, just create a conversation about this. I mean, and it's hard to have the conversation in this movie when you don't include Allen Iverson in the movie, or any of the three defendants that victims of,
I think, oh yeah,
of this. You know, they had one or two TV clips of them talking about some of the injuries that they received, but that was pretty much their only inclusion in this. So in trying to, you know, work from outside of the case itself in regards to what the environment of their upbringing and their life and their neighborhood was, I think that was his point, and I thought he did an extremely good job of it.
Agree. And I think that I think the story ended up being like, he's trying, I think, as he goes along, to figure out where the story is and where the conversation is. And in the course of doing that, he's including a lot of stuff that is not flattering to him, including, and this will be in our visual aids, a side-by-side comparison of his basketball accomplishments and Allen Iverson's accomplishments, including a yearbook photo of Bill James shooting, I guess, or rebounding, that is hilarable. I mean, it's just ridiculous looking, and he's just like, well, like, I was a tall guy and I did my best, like, I don't know, 11 points per game isn't bad, that's better than I could do. But yeah, I think that this is 30 for 30's great gift often with so many stories just from the first season, like you don't know Bo was second season, I think, but like Run Ricky Run, the Marcus Dupree one, that they're so smart about letting the real issues that sports sometimes are actually quote about, but like bubble up through the narrative and just raising questions and being okay with some discomfort. Like the Hillsborough one was
phenomenal.
So like I can never watch it again because I felt physically ill.
Yeah.
Like physically trampled actually after watching it, which I think was the point. And it's quite a stunning thing to, you know, from a TV movie basically. But yeah, 30 for 30, I think at least is taking big swings all the time. And certainly this one, it was, I liked revisiting it. Like I'm almost never unhappy to watch them again. And that this one was one of the first ones made and still has things to tell us on a number of different levels about these conversations is great. And have you watched the other Iverson documentary?
I have actually. And actually, you brought it up before. I was going to say it probably is a good sequel to this because it really gets into, I think it was one of the writers from this documentary from the newspaper, not Jim Spencer, but the other one whose name I'm forgetting right now. He was the one who used the first use of the word thug in this documentary.
Oh, okay.
This other Allen Iverson documentary kind of goes into to the quote unquote thuggish attitude of Allen Iverson because he was like the first player in the NBA to have all the tattoos.
Oh, okay.
This is all common now in the NBA. If you don't have a tattoo, you're the one who looks weird out on the court in the NBA now. But when Allen Iverson was out on the court and he had the cornrows and he had, you know, tattoos from head to toe on his body, that's when the word thug kind of kept getting thrown around at him more often because of the way that he presented himself with his look. You see that all the time now in the NBA and in college basketball and even in high school basketball at this point, that it's just a cultural point of cultural relevance these days of, you know, everybody has a tattoo anymore. But the way it was portrayed against Allen Iverson is kind of the point of that follow-up documentary. And like I said, it kind of does make a good follow-up sequel to what we saw here.
But yeah, even if you don't have Netflix, I don't know. I think the 30 for 30, which is on Amazon Prime and 30 for 30's air, like, in the middle of the night on various ESPNs and sometimes your local sports network, like MSG runs them here in the New York area a lot. So just set your DVR to trap all of them, including old ones, and look out for it.
Yeah, I actually got it off of YouTube when I watched it this time. So, it was a dollar less expensive than Amazon. So, go ahead, go save a buck.
News you can use, folks.
Yeah.
Speaking of news you can use, do you have anything you'd like to plug, Mike Dunn?
My Twitter account, I guess. MikeyWMFree.
All right.
That's about all I have.
What do you talk about on there? What sports can people look forward to?
They can look forward to me talking about Crystal Palace soccer, New York Red Bull soccer, excuse me, football. Won't be talking about the Jets. Won't be talking about the Devils because they're not going anywhere in the playoffs. Maybe some music comments here and there. But, all right.
The occasional Red Sox starting pitching rant, like the one I was treated to before we started recording.
Yes.
Thank you for coming back on the show. And yes, if we do an all tennis episode, you and past guest John Ramos will have to do a two-pronged attack.
That would be great. Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Folks, coming up on The Blotter Presents, Jeb Lund returns to talk about Madeleine McCann and something else we haven't decided yet. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. Email me at bunting@the-blotter.com and or become a Patreon tipster at The Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, I would love it if you could tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find it. If you don't like the podcast, I would love it if you kept that fact to yourself. My guest has been Mike Dunn, and as he said, he's on Twitter at MikeyWMFree. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.